Live from the nation's capital, President Joe Biden and comedian Colin Jost headlined the White House Correspondents' Dinner. See all the biggest stars together in one room live April 27th at 8 p.m. on CNN and streaming on Max.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Crossing the channel in this lethal way, in a small boat, is not the way to come to our country.
This after the biggest death toll of its kind. 27 migrants drowned in the English Channel. We seek answers from Oxford University migration expert Alexander Betts and a Macron ally, the MEP Nathalie Loiseau. Then, Libya at a crossroads after Muammar Gaddafi's son is disqualified from his presidential bid. Journalist Robert Worth interviewed him and tells us why a Gaddafi thought he could win. Also ahead, the International Olympic Committee under fire over the way it's handling the Me Too case of Chinese tennis star Peng Shuai. I speak to senior IOC official Dick Pound. And finally,
I didn't want the Germans to have the satisfaction of killing me, of having me dead.
An incredible story of survival and Thanksgiving. We look back at my conversation with concentration camp survivor Selma van der Peer.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London, where the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, is under fire for migrant crossings in the English Channel that have turned shockingly deadly. While in France, five suspected people smugglers have been arrested and face manslaughter charges. Yesterday, 27 people drowned shortly after setting off from France. They were trying to reach the UK on an inflatable boat, and it's the largest such loss of life there. President Emmanuel Macron and Prime Minister Boris Johnson have agreed to take urgent action. Listen.
I say to our partners across the channel, now is the time for us all to step up, to work together, to do everything we can to break these gangs who are literally getting away with murder.
We are holding this border for the UK. They don't want asylum in France. We will improve our means to increase protection, but we need to work as partners.
More than 25,000 migrants have made the crossing so far this year. That's compared to about 8,000 the year before. And they are still coming, despite what happened in the Channel. With me now to discuss this is the MEP and former French Minister for Europe, Nathalie Loiseau, and Professor Alexander Betts, the leading expert on forced migration at Oxford University. Thank you both for joining me. Let me ask you for the politicians' view of this, because it is an issue, Nathalie, that has been highly politicized. And yet you just heard both leaders saying we must put that aside and work as partners. What actually do you think they can do to stop what is a surge now in these crossings of the Channel?
Well, first of all, before talking about politics and numbers, let's remember that we are talking about human beings and human lives which were lost, because this is a tragedy we are talking about. Are we talking about a surge? Let me tell you, and I might surprise you, that I doubt it. The number of asylum seekers in the United Kingdom this year is approximately around 25,000 to 30,000, whereas in France at the same time, it's more than 100,000. And it's much less than in 2016, for instance, because there has been cooperation between the UK and France. A number of smugglers have been arrested. A number of people who intended to cross the channel were stopped. The crossings through the tunnel have diminished very significantly in the five last years, which unfortunately led people to risk their life crossing with more boats. But we are not talking about a surge. Of course, we can do better, but there are things that we will not manage to do.
Well, Natalie, what should the French do? I mean, you say there isn't a surge, and maybe you're absolutely right, and I'll get Alexander's take on that. But, you know, the 25,000 this year compared to about 8,000 last year across this channel, it represents, you know, not just double, but more than double the number. What can France do about this? What does working as a partner actually mean?
Well, we are having patrols around the port of Calais and also on the beaches. But we have to realize that migrants leave from very different places. They are spread all around, all along the coasts. And if the promise of British authorities is zero migration, it's a promise that cannot be fulfilled because it doesn't exist anywhere on Earth. The UK has left the European Union, but it hasn't left planet Earth. So we are doing our best. We are making more patrols. We are mostly working with other European member states, Belgium, Germany, and others, to crack down the networks of smugglers, because these people are criminals. They know that they put human lives at risk. And we have to do more. Mm-hmm. We do it with the British authorities as well. We give a lot of information from our side to the British partners on networks of smuggler. Maybe our British partners could reciprocate and give us the information they have, because if they have networks of smugglers, some of them live in the UK and welcome the migrants.
So, Alexander, let me put it to you. You've been following this for a long, long time. So put it in perspective. Natalie says there's no surge. And just tell me what that looks like to you, because here, the government anyway, acts as if this country is under constant invasion by mostly Muslim migrants. What are the facts? And what do you say has led to this crisis right now in the Channel?
So this was a predictable and entirely avoidable tragedy. It stems from a failure of political leadership by governments on both sides of the English Channel. And it's clear that we do need a sense of perspective, that there is very far from being a refugee or a so-called migrant crisis, that the numbers of asylum seekers arriving in the UK and indeed in Europe should not be understood to be a crisis. Politicians have been exaggerating this in the UK, but also elsewhere. But what is happening is there are record numbers of asylum seekers coming to the UK, or at least the highest level in the year ending September 2021 since 2004. So in that year, there were 37,000 asylum applications in the UK, and the proportion of asylum seekers coming across the English Channel has grown. So in that sense, there is an increase, but we do need to keep it in perspective. We need to recognise that against the backdrop of 82 million displaced people around the world, 26 million of whom are refugees, countries like Turkey hosting 3.7 million refugees, countries like Colombia hosting 1.7 million refugees, that the numbers we're talking about in Europe as a whole and in the UK should be seen in perspective. They're relatively small. Mm-hmm. But why are the numbers increasing? Well, firstly, they're increasing because more people are displaced around the world. The people who are coming are fleeing desperate situations. They're fleeing authoritarian governments, violence, conflict. They're mostly coming from countries where we know many refugees are fleeing. Countries like Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Yemen, Syria. Those are the types of countries that people are coming from. They're fleeing desperate circumstances. The second reason is because there's really no other way to seek asylum in the UK. It's been made so difficult by the British government and other European countries that the only way to seek asylum in the UK is by using smuggling networks to cross illegally. Mm-hmm. If there were safe routes, if there were safe passages and alternative pathways, asylum seekers would be able to use them.
So you said a failure of leadership on both sides of the channel. And before I go back to Natalie, who's obviously a politician, I want to know what you mean by that and what specifically the British government could do from your perspective, where we are here in the UK, to ameliorate this situation? Because as Natalie said, these are people, desperate people. There were men, there were women, some pregnant, there were some younger people, children. I mean, it's a real tragedy.
Yes, these are some 30 human beings, including a pregnant woman, at least two children. We know that some were Kurds fleeing Iraq. We know that some were Somalis. They're fleeing desperate circumstances. And I think it's all too easy for politicians to blame the smugglers and to talk about breaking up the smuggling networks. And of course, nobody could disagree with that. There are merciless, greedy smuggling networks exploiting people's vulnerability. But there's still more that politicians can do by cooperating. Mm-hmm. France, the UK, and the European Union need to work together. For too long, there's been squabbling and nationalist pandering rather than moral leadership. The moral position is to say the numbers across the European Union should be manageable and should be shared equitably. There need to be safe passages within Europe, and there needs to be a way of creating responsibility sharing. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Brexit has changed the dynamic between the UK and France and the UK and the rest of the European Union, but we need to set that aside and come up with ways of sharing refugees in a more just way and ensuring that there's some safe passage from Europe to the UK. I think that's the ethical thing to do. And we need to realise that lives are at stake. And if we had a realistic framework, everyone would benefit from the predictability, the cooperation, enabling desperate people to come and claim refugee status. Because one thing's clear, is that the majority of people claiming asylum in the UK are being recognised as either refugees or people in need of international protection. Last year, the grant of international protection status was around 50% at first instance decision making, that first bureaucratic choice. And on appeal, a larger proportion were then recognised. So most people arriving as asylum seekers are in need right. of protection. Mm-hmm. But let's make it safe.
Right. And of course, that goes against what the British Home Secretary says, who says most people coming here are just, you know, economic opportunists or economic migrants. But you're giving us the facts and figures of the fact that they actually are desperate and fall into those internationally recognized categories that require and should have help. But Natalie, I want to ask you, because tell me whether you think your own interior minister has politicized the situation in this. And I'll read you what he said. He basically says the British companies are creating incentives for this kind of travel across. In a radio interview, he said, "Everyone knows that there are more than a million illegal immigrants in the UK and that English employers use this workforce. English employers use this labour to make the things that the English manufacture and consume. We say reform your labour market. Tell English employers that we need them to be as patriotic as the Conservative government." Tell me about what you... Do you agree with that, Natalie, that English companies seeing an opportunity, I guess, for cheap, unregulated labour are part of the problem?
Well, I don't want to enter into a blame game because it will not help working together. We could as well say that in the United Kingdom, there is no mandatory carrying of an ID, and maybe it makes it simpler for undocumented migrants mm-hmm. to try and risk entering the UK. But my point is not there. My point is that Brexit was supposed to be about taking back control and being able to have a brighter future without the European Union and without European partners. What we are seeing now is that, first of all, Brexit was never able to stop migration from people coming from outside the European Union, and this is what's taking place now. And, of course, in challenges like migration, which are worldwide, the only possible answer is cooperation. We need each other. We need a positive atmosphere to work on this. Because let me be very frank, I'm a politician. I listen to my fellow citizens. They are asking time and again why French taxpayers' money is being spent to protect the British border. We can explain it, but there is a need for a positive atmosphere, for stopping the blame game, for the will to cooperate, and for a rational conversation, not using migrants as a scapegoat or the European Union as a scapegoat.
OK, very, very quickly, because I want to turn to Alexander. The British government have said that they will up the amount of money they give France and to try to help with the situation. Would France accept British police on French soil to police that area? Yes or no?
Well, let us be very clear. It's a question of sovereignty.
Right.
We are a sovereign country. Second, I talked about the length of the shores where migrants may try to cross the channel. And third, when you go to the beaches, it's already too late because people are here and will always try to cross. The very thing to do is to fight against the roots of migration, to be more active in conflict resolution. I am appealed to see that the United Kingdom downsized its development assistance.
Okay.
If you want to have less migrants, let's have a better support for developing countries to begin with.
Well, that's a point, isn't it, Alexander? And, of course, the Brexit point. Can I just ask you what some have been talking about in this instance? We've all seen the lack of workers here in the UK for vital jobs, whether it's drivers, whether it's, you know, in the farming industry, et cetera, et cetera. And some are saying, and you've written the book, The Wealth of Refugees, I think, and how these people can actually rebuild economies. Is this a moment when actually the British should be thinking, hey, we don't have these European workers anymore. We need people. Many of these are skilled or skillable, teachable, and should we have them in our country?
So the majority of people coming across the English Channel seeking asylum are in need of international protection, and they don't represent a threat to the United Kingdom. But they represent a possibility to contribute to the economy. We know that many asylum seekers and refugees contribute to economies around the world, including the UK economy. The UK faces a demographic challenge of having a population that is aging, of having a population that doesn't always want to take some of the low-paid jobs. And there's a need to fill some of those gaps. We've seen recently the UK pioneering something quite exciting, which is offering opportunities for refugee health workers to come and support the British National Health Service, to work in particular hospitals and contribute that way, and it's been a success. So I think it's absolutely right to recognise that refugees can be an asset. They have skills, they have talents, they have aspirations, they can be contributors. And so the portrayal of not just the British government, but other governments, of refugees as an inevitable burden is something I think we have to challenge, particularly given that the numbers are quite small.
Yes, the numbers are quite small. I really think that's something that we should really try to cement because it does get blown out of proportion and leads to this terrible, terrible tragedy that we've just seen. Alexander Bez, Nathalie Loiseau, thank you so much. Libya is a transit country for migrants, as we know, desperate to reach Europe. You'll remember how politicians lamented the Mediterranean becoming a watery cemetery. Well, last week alone, 75 died. That's on top of the tens of thousands who've perished in these crossings over the years. Now, for the first time since the Arab Spring, Libya is about to hold its first ever direct presidential elections. None other than Saif Gaddafi. The son of the ousted dictator Muammar Gaddafi has registered to run, but last night he was barred by Libya's election commission. Can next month's vote really bring some kind of order to this dysfunctional and divided country? Well, journalist Robert Worth has spent months tracking down Saif Gaddafi to ask, and he's joining me now from France. Robert Worth, welcome to the program. I think, you know, everybody was quite taken by the first interview that you managed to get with Saif al-Islam is his formal name, but he's the son of Muammar Gaddafi. He had been held by militants for a number of years. When you spoke to him, what did he tell you about why he wanted to run and whether he really thought that it was, you know, it was OK for a Gaddafi to try to run again in this post-Arab Spring world?
I think Saif al-Islam is banking on there being, and there is, quite a bit of nostalgia for the Gaddafi era, amazingly enough. I mean, after all, Gaddafi was known as a brutal dictator, all kinds of human rights abuses. I think, though, what has happened in the 10 years, the Gaddafi regime was followed by the Libya collapsing into a patchwork of militias, And many of those militia leaders also committed terrible, terrible atrocities. And this is what's foremost in people's minds. So strangely enough, someone who's from an earlier period of Libya's history, like Saif al-Islam, can count on some people looking back and saying, well, at least it was more stable at that time. At least we had something. And I think he does believe that he, not just he himself, I should say, because he was trying to run for president, but his movement, which is essentially his father's movement. And people, there is going to be not only a presidential election, but parliamentary elections. And so he's backing a number of other candidates who stand with him. And he thinks that they all have a chance running on this kind of tide of nostalgia.
Well, I mean, he's been barred. I mean, will he still run? I mean, he's been barred by the Election Commission. And what effect do you think that'll have if he does, in fact, have a popular base?
Well, he can appeal the ruling. He's certainly, you know, he may well remain ousted from this. So far, it doesn't look as if his disqualification has caused any violence or anything of that kind. But I suspect that even if he is unable to run for president, he may still have quite an impact by, as I say, backing parliamentary candidates. And at some point in the future, he may well be able to run. I should add also that it's entirely possible that this election, which is scheduled for December 24th, won't happen on time. And there's been quite a bit of chaos in terms of the administrative side of things. So who knows, you know, when these elections will take place and whether he will, in fact, be able to run.
So I want to play a little snippet from the interview you did with him, because it's very similar. Well, we'll see. I want to play a snippet of what you did and then 10 plus years ago, a snippet of what I did with him before the fall of his father. So here's from your New York Times interview.
If the Libyans choose a strong president, the only thing we need is a strong president. That's it. The Libyans will choose a strong one. Then everything will be solved automatically. Yeah. It's as simple as that.
So as simple as that. And I just wonder, when we play this snippet from my interview in 2011 with him, on the verge of his father being run out of his, you know, leadership, whether he seems to have changed at all. Here's what he told me. Will there be a new regime?
If you are strong, they love you. If not, they say goodbye. And it's good, we get rid of them. Hypocrites.
Do you think they'll get rid of you?
No. They are the losers. They have no future.
I don't know, Bobby. He seems to exist on a plane that's not really rooted in reality, because shortly after he said that to me, they were out. And shortly after he said that to you, which was practically the same thing, Libya needs a strong person, you know, he was barred. Did you get a sense that he was grounded in some kind of reality, or is just nostalgic?
I think he's very much the son of a dictator, and he's never really been able to emerge from that shell. You know, I spent years trying to meet with him, because I was curious. You know, after all, he went through a lot during those years. First, his father was killed. His brothers were killed in 2011. He was taken captive. He was injured at the time. He lost a couple of fingers on his hand. He was quite sick. And then he was a prisoner in the desert and essentially vanished. Nobody knew where he was. And he lived alone much of that time in a basement prison, as he told me when I met him a few months ago. So you would think that someone who'd gone through so much might have had time to re-examine his life and his role in the country and learn something, let's say. But as you pointed out with those two clips, which really do, I think, tell you something, he still has that same sense of himself. He still thinks that he can just walk into that role and act as if the whole past 10 years never happened.
And then there's another one contesting the election, General Haftar, and he's been, you know, accused of sort of stirring up the civil war there, and certainly not helping out. I wonder what you think, if an election does happen, it's scheduled on the 24th, you said it might slip. But let me just read, you know, some of the things that aren't provided for. No provisions for power sharing after the elections, no safeguards to ensure the vote's integrity. And could it, do you think, possibly be a big gamble that could just tip Libya back into you know, local clashes, armed conflict that we've seen over the last, you know, 11 years?
Yes, I do. I think that's entirely possible. That, you know, as we've seen in other elections in troubled countries, elections can, you know, provide a better, greater sense of legitimacy, or they can very well do the opposite. They can tumble a country further into chaos. And because you have very divisive figures running in this election, there is absolutely the possibility that this could make things worse. You mentioned Khalifa Haftar. I mean, he's considered by many in Libya to be a war criminal as well. And he, you know, he was very much involved in the war that could have destroyed the capital, Tripoli, that ended only last year. And he's someone who now rules essentially over much of eastern Libya. And so I think, you know, if he wins or loses, you could see a lot of discontent among different sectors of the Libyan population. I should add also that it's possible that he could be disqualified from the election as well. He hasn't been yet, but the Election Commission has said that they will be doing more reviews and possibly will disqualify other people. And Haftar was an American citizen. This would bar him from running for president. You're not allowed to be a dual citizen. Haftar claims that he's no longer an American citizen, just a Libyan one, but we haven't seen the evidence on that. So that remains to be seen.
Well, that was going to be my next question. What does America want to see happen in Libya? Because right now we've got a lot of Russians backing one side, a lot of Turkish forces backing another side. It's already being, you know, swallowed up by entities that are not necessarily, you know, certainly not necessarily in the best interest of the United States or Europe. What is the lay of the land that exists there right now?
Well, as you say, the Libyan civil war became a proxy battleground with Russia and Turkey playing prominent roles, but other countries as well, including Egypt, United Arab Emirates, and France. And one real triumph that took place last year was that under the auspices of the United Nations, there was a peace deal. There's now a transition government. Those foreign actors do still have soldiers on the ground, but they're not fighting. At least we don't have a war in the country. Mm-hmm. As for what the United States would like, I think they simply want to stabilize Libya and hopefully build a more legitimate government, or rather to see a more legitimate government. The Biden administration is awfully busy, as we all know, on the home front. And, you know, we've had this very tumultuous thing happen recently in Afghanistan. I don't think the Biden administration wants to commit much attention or resources, certainly not to Libya. But I think they very much would like to see this place, which, after all, was something of a black mark. President Obama called it his biggest mistake a few years ago because of the role that the United States played in that NATO mission that helped to bring down Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. So we've got some skin in the game, but I think the Biden administration really wants to avoid getting drawn in.
And yet, as we've seen with all the migrants crossing and the instability, it's something that really does need to be taken care of. Bobby Wirth, thank you so much indeed. Now, concern continues to grow for the welfare of the Chinese tennis star Peng Shuai, who recently accused a senior Communist Party leader of sexual assault. She disappeared from public view soon after that, and the Women's Tennis Association, the WTA, is threatening to pull tournaments out of China. But in just a few months, China will host the Winter Olympics. And now the International Olympic Committee is under fire for its handling of the Peng case, releasing this picture, but little else, of a weekend video call between Peng and the IOC president and declaring her safe and well. Dick Pound is one of the most senior and longest serving IOC officials, and he's joining me now from Paris. So, Dick Pound, welcome to the program. This has become not just about Peng now, but about how people on the outside or institutions on the outside are handling this case. So what do you make of all the criticism that's come down on the president of the IOC and the IOC itself for what they consider an unsatisfactory intervention in this case with that video call?
Well, I must say I'm really puzzled by that assessment of it. I mean, basically, lots of people around the world were looking to see what happened to Peng Shuai, and nobody was able to establish contact. only the IOC was able to do so. And there was a conversation that was held by video with Thomas Bach, who's an older Olympian, and two younger female IOC members. And it was nobody's released the video because I guess that aspect of it was private. But they found her in good health and in good spirits, and they saw no evidence of confinement or anything like that. And she wanted to spend some time with her family and friends, and they agreed that, well, you know, the Thomas Bach said, look, I'll be in Beijing in a month or two. Let's get together and have lunch or something and continue our conversation. And so if you're really concerned about Peng, you've got some good news.
Well,
but for some reason.
Yeah. I guess the question is beyond proof of life video, which this clearly seemed to be, what else was achieved? Because does, for instance, Mr. Bach know that, you know, out of camera range, there weren't officials sitting with her, and censoring her? Why does the IOC not release its part of the video call? I mean, you know that there's so many questions beyond just seeing her talking, and the WTA is really not satisfied at all, nor are the human rights organizations. So I'm just wondering why you put yourself in this position of not just putting out even more that you have at your disposal.
Well, I think the idea was to be assured, insofar as one can, and as IOC members and so forth, including a Chinese female member, that she was healthy, not being confined, and she's happy enough to get together with the same folks who are on the call later in Beijing. So I think, if nothing else, you can have quite a lot of confidence that she'll be in good shape up to and including Beijing. And I think that's what we were concerned about. Now, the ATP may have its own views, but I don't think they've been paying much attention to what's happened in basketball and football in threatening the Chinese with economic sanctions on this. It's not going to work. And part of the proof of the pudding is they were not able to get in touch with her. And that's her sport. And maybe she didn't like the attitude that they were showing. Now, whether that was discussed on the video or not, I don't know. It may be one of the ground rules was that the full content would not be released because there may have been some private matters discussed in the course of the 30-minute conversation. But, I mean, there's been criticism said, well, you had this conversation and you haven't resolved the harassment charges.
Right.
Well, of course not.
Right.
That takes a lot more time and a lot more evidence to...
It does. What I'd like to know is very, very quickly, yes or no, have you actually seen the tape of this call?
I have not.
No. Do you know what's in it? Have you asked Thomas Bach what exactly they talked about, given that you've been doing a lot of press about it?
No, I haven't. I'm simply relying on the combined judgment of the three IOC members who were on the call.
Okay. Why do you think that she was... I mean, you've been around the block a lot and you've dealt with a lot of controversies, over the years in sports and politics and all the rest of it. Why do you think she was censored on Chinese media and stayed out of public view for these long weeks and has very senior members of her sports, from Billie Jean King to Serena Williams, not to mention the WTA, so concerned and worried?
Well, I think the Chinese system of monitoring what goes on to the internet or whatever particular medium that was is very sensitive about anything that's critical of senior members of the government. So I think the post was taken down within 20 or 30 minutes. That's kind of standard operating procedure. But I think that her status in the community and in China at large hasn't taken it any further than that, and whether there are discussions going on with her and the Chinese authorities about, I mean, was this really a complaint which you want resolved, or was it a post about an experience that started off apparently with coercion and then may have evolved into something that was consensual, or at least quasi-consensual? And so I don't know that.
Yeah. So let me ask you this then. The WTA wants an investigation, and I just want to know whether you agree with them. It says of your call that it does not change our call for a full, fair, and transparent investigation without censorship into her allegation of sexual assault, which is the issue that gave rise to our initial concern. Would you support an investigation by the Chinese, by whoever, and do you have any certitude that she was not being confined when the president of the IOC actually spoke to her on that video call?
Well, I think you can fake some things, and they were satisfied. All three of them were satisfied that she's alive and healthy and not under coercion. And so I think the first thing you have to do is figure out what was she trying to accomplish with the post. Was it just to tell her story, or did she want an investigation and consequences if she was able to establish the coercion? Mm-hmm.
Do you, I guess, again, support an investigation? But also, I wonder whether you are concerned, or whether the IOC is concerned, of a potential conflict of interest, or the perception of a conflict of interest, or at least a conflict, given that the person she accuses, Zhang Gaoli, is a very senior Communist Party official, at least was at the time, and was the specific individual tasked with the Olympic bid, therefore negotiating with your president and et cetera, selling China to the, China's position to host the Winter Olympics, which it has and it will in this winter. Does it bother you that of all people, he's the one who is the link between the IOC and the Chinese government?
No, we don't really have links with the Chinese government. We're pretty careful about compartmentalizing the organization of the Olympics. These are not government games. These are IOC games, and there's an organizing committee that is responsible for that, which is certainly, from what I've heard, whenever there's anything that borders on a requirement that the Chinese government act, the organizing committee has a tendency of throwing up its hand and saying, well, that's a government matter, and we're just involved in organizing the Olympics. And by the way, if you look back at the awarding of the games to Beijing, it was not a sure thing by any means. They came within 4 votes of losing to Kazakhstan. Mm-hmm. So there's no involvement of the governments per se in any of that selection. It's a matter of, can you organize the games, and are you a member in good standing? Is your Olympic committee a member in good standing of the Olympic family?
Well, it would be great, I think, if the IOC would be able to release that video call, because it would answer quite a lot of people's questions and might go some way to figuring out what's actually happening. Be great if you could lobby on our behalf for that. Dick Pound, thank you so much indeed. I'm being serious. And finally, for Americans everywhere, it is Thanksgiving. So we thought we'd end this edition of our program with an amazing story of survival, courage, and gratitude that we came upon this year. Back in May, I spoke to the incredible 99-year-old Dutch woman, Selma van der Peer. Selma was just a teenager when the Nazis invaded her homeland. She became a resistance fighter and a Holocaust survivor. She finally revealed it all in her book, My Name is Selma. When we spoke, she told me the family she lost back then has never left her thoughts. Selma van der Peer, welcome to our program. It's a really big honor to have you. So I want to start by asking you, what was it like there before the war? What do you remember about Holland before the invasion?
Well, we were not living in a particularly Jewish neighborhood, and we were not friends with only Jews. I had many girlfriends from school as well, and most of them were Catholic or Protestant. We knew one was Protestant and the other was Catholic, and I was Jewish and so. But it didn't make any difference. We were just all friends. And I remember that very well.
You remember everybody living together?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then everything obviously changed. The Nazis invaded the Netherlands. I think you were 18 years old.
17.
What did you know about the Nazis? I mean, did you know that it was then going to be dangerous for Jewish people yourself?
We didn't know 100% what happened, of course, because the Germans were very careful, very clever. They never told people, states or countries, what they were going to do. They just did, slowly but surely. And so we knew what had happened in Germany and Austria and Czechoslovakia and so, but not really. We didn't know about the extermination camps. Well, not the public did, at least.
4 days after the invasion, Holland surrendered.
Yeah.
And somehow you knew that you had to get your sister and your mother to safety. What happened to you and your siblings at that time?
Well, not straight away after the invasion, because, as I said, the Germans were very clever. We didn't realize what was going to happen. The Dutch thought the whole Dutch Netherlands government and country, people in the country, thought the First World War, they had been not in the war, and they had been neutral. And they thought this was going to happen again this time. So people didn't think about the worst yet.
What happened to your father?
Well, after a year in 1941, the orders about against Jews started, not being able to go on the trams, on the trains, in the cafes, or the cinema, etc. But in 1942, the Germans, or the Nazis, my friend says, I have to say, not Germans, a Nazi started, Germans started to call up Jewish people. First of all, the German refugees and so, and then Jewish girls and boys and men. And I got my call up on the 7th of June, my birthday, 1942. And my father said, no, you don't go. And my father got a call up in October. And they were told, people were told by the Jewish Council, who were told by the Germans, no doubt, that they were going to a work camp in the north of Holland. That was the call up. And so he thought, and also they were told that if they went, then their wives and children would be free, didn't need to go to a work camp. And everybody believed that.
And of course it was a terrible
lie. And it wasn't true at all. That's what I tried to tell you. There were so many lies, slowly but surely, they told. And we were not, don't forget, we were, now we know what happened, but we didn't in those days, you see.
Your father was taken off.
Yes, so my father went to that work camp one evening, and the next day they were straightway transferred to a transfer camp called Westerbork in the north of Holland, where Jews were later on all the time transferred to before being sent to Auschwitz, the extermination camp Auschwitz. They were also collecting wives and children, so that was not true either. The next day, we were not called, thank God, otherwise I wouldn't be sitting here. I said to my mother, when we heard that my father was sent to Westerbork, we better go and hide, because if they haven't called us last night, they will come tonight. And that's what happened. I went to friends who knew about a man who had addresses for hiding. And my mother and sister went into a hiding place in Eindhoven in the south of Holland. And they stayed there till 1943 when they were betrayed.
And did your mother and your sister survive?
No, they were sent straight away. They were sent to Westerbork and then to Auschwitz, and they were killed, murdered straight away.
And you, but not with them?
No, I didn't with them. Number one, it cost a lot of money. And number two, the woman only could have two. So you needed people, and it wasn't easy in the beginning to find houses where people were willing to take Jews in.
And she could only take two people. So what did you decide
to
do?
So I went to evening classes to learn typing and shorthand when I left school in 1941 and grammar school. And one girl there, with whom I had become friendly, said, if there's any trouble, you can come to us. So that's what I did. I went to them and hid there for a week. And then her mother told me that it was getting too dangerous and could I please go? So I was then looking for hiding place again, and I went to several hiding places.
You joined the resistance. How did that happen?
They were short because all the young people could not be out for that anymore, help for that anymore. And they needed to. So I said one evening, can I help? And they said, oh yes, would you please? And I said, yes. So the first week I just put resistance papers into envelopes because we weren't allowed to have, papers weren't allowed to be published anymore.
The Nazis banned all that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you also had to change your identity. You were Salma.
Yeah. And then the resistance thought I was, a different name was better. Because by that time, the resistance had influence already with the main resistance in the Netherlands. They all had joined up with each other, luckily, and good. And so the resistance asked me, would I be willing to take another name?
Yeah, and you became Marga. And in your book, you write, ever since joining the resistance, I'd buried my true self. I consciously denied my essence, my Selma, the whole time.
That's true.
What did that mean?
Well, it meant that I hid it away. I went into hiding as Selma. I tried to forget that I was Selma because I was scared that I would talk in my sleep, especially when I was in prison. I hardly dared sleep because I was so scared that I would.
That you'd betray yourself?
Yeah. I had that all the time, actually.
That fear of betraying yourself?
Yeah. All the time I was imprisoned during the war.
Well, I'm going to get to the prison in a moment, but first I'd like to ask you to read on page 76 in your book there, the passage about fear, about how, you know, fear was everywhere, but you had to put it to the back of your mind.
Yeah, you forget about fear because I was busy as well, like I was now. When you're busy, you're able to push the things where you don't need. You can't live in constant fear. Even fear is something to which you become accustomed. Quite true. And the job, the resistance job, becomes like any other job. Every day I did things that put my life at risk. I didn't allow the fear to overwhelm me. The desire to thwart the Nazis and help people in danger was stronger.
I mean, it's really a powerful statement because everybody wonders how they would act when confronted with such a terrifying situation. And from what I read, the most terrifying and daring thing you did was go to Paris to Nazi headquarters. Tell me about that.
Well, it was. They asked me to go to Paris because they needed some papers from the Germans. And the resistance day. And so I said, oh, no, it's too dangerous. I don't want to go. I didn't want to go. I thought it was much too dangerous. And but they said it was needed because they had people, two boys in prison, and they wanted, or a few boys, and they wanted them out.
So they had captured these Dutch political prisoners?
Yeah.
What were the papers that you were taking?
Well, I didn't see them, really. I only had an envelope which I took back. But the papers were official German papers, which the Germans had to carry with them if they wanted to go into a prison or so. So the resistance wanted to go into that prison and get the boys out, which they did.
You then did get arrested.
Yes.
But well, not because you were Jewish, but you got arrested for your as a political prisoner and sent to Ravensbrück, the women's concentration camp near Berlin. What was that like?
That was horrible.
Because you weren't taken in as a Jew, did you think that maybe you would be spared the worst? What was going through your mind?
Because we didn't really know what was happening to Jews. Don't forget that. We do now.
Yeah.
But we didn't. So, no. No, I did know, of course, that for Jews it might have been very much more dangerous, in a way, being sent to Poland to work. And we did know, of course, that none of them had come back.
What was your experience in Ravensbrück?
Well, I've had some very horrible experiences there, too. But I survived. I didn't want the Germans to have the satisfaction of killing me, of having me dead. So I did everything to stay alive. I was quite lucky in a way that I became the secretary of one of the chiefs in Siemens factory. I had to work in the Siemens factory.
The big German industrial,
Siemens and Halske.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is now famous for all the kitchen stuff. Yeah.
You said that to survive, you had to maintain hope.
Yeah. So you try to do your best to survive, which was difficult at some times. I was beaten once, unconscious, when I couldn't get off the loo because my tummy was always upset, you see. And because the food and the drinks we got was terrible or hardly anything.
When you came out, you realized eventually that your mother had not survived, your father had not, and nor had your younger sister. Two older brothers had, and they had come here to England. How did you reconcile, how did you process their loss?
Well, I haven't reconciled with that at all. I think of them every day, every night, small things happen. And when I slice my bread in the morning for breakfast, and I half my slice of bread, I think of my mother when she buttered our bread. I can't help it. It comes into my mind. I try not to because I say to myself, it doesn't make any difference. You can't make it undone. But I can't help it. I think of them every day in that way.
Did you talk about it throughout your life? You're now writing this incredible memoir about your life in the resistance. Was the war something you would talk to your friends about, to your son, to your
family? No, the first 30 years, I didn't talk about it at all, except perhaps that I had been in the camp, but not detailed. And a little bit with my husband when I met him, because he told me about his. But not much either. And then the Dutch Association for Women of Ravensbrück emailed me or phoned me and asked me to go to Ravensbrück with the schools they go to. And I said, no, I'm too busy building up my life. That was another thing. I was building up my life, you see. I was trying to get married and have a child and so. So I was busy again. And so, no. And I said to them, no. But then, a few years after that, they phoned and wrote and said, we're going to Ravensbrück for a week with a workshop with teachers, people who have just finished the college for teaching. And they're going. So about 80 of them went to Ravensbrück, and I went with them. And I said, yes, that's a good idea, I thought, because if I could tell teachers what had happened there, then they could tell the children. That was the whole idea of the workshop. And that's what happened. And since then, I've been every year.
Fantastic. Do you think that your experience, obviously the experience of the Holocaust, the history, will remain in generations to come? Are you concerned that the longer we move away
a bit,
from that?
Yes, I was. That's one of the reasons. There are several reasons I wrote the book. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book. Because with the book there, and especially now it's been so successful, I hope that it will remain, yes. And I hope that people will talk about it still. But a main thing is, because of the experiences, I hope that it won't happen again.
So I was going to ask you, what do you think when you see
something happening now? Yeah.
Whether it was in Cambodia or in Bosnia or in Rwanda, now they call what's happening, you know, in China a genocide to the Uyghurs.
Very disappointed I am that people haven't learned from the... Mind you, it is very, very bad what happens there, but nothing like the Holocaust.
Selma van der Peer, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
What an incredible, elegant woman. And that's it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thanks for watching. Goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.